Welcome to Crosstalk, the number one podcast in the entire galaxy, says me. Just kidding. But we would love for you to follow, like, ring the bell, and comment. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. If you agree or disagree, we're open to a conversation and we love your feedback. I'm really excited today. I have a friend of mine, Michael, who I met actually during COVID. Like a year into COVID, basically, like to set, like, no, yeah, maybe a little less than that, yeah, but I'm really excited. So Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And, you know, here on Crosstalk, we really try to highlight people's stories and their lives during addiction and behavioral stuff, you know, which goes hand in hand. So, you know, basically it goes like, how did it start? You know, how did it progress? What happens? You know, what went down, kind of thing?
Yeah, I grew up in Westchester, New York, which is, you know, in the early 70s, mid 70s, in a normal, like, you know, environment. My parents, you know, were married, happily married. I had an older sister, 4 years older. You know, it was like white picket fence kind of story. And from the outside, it looked great. You know, there was nothing, I had no childhood trauma. There was no instance for anything like that. But I do recall my earliest memories were full of fear. I heard some words in recovery that helped describe that fear. It was riddled with fear. A buddy of mine used that and I was like, that's how I felt. Everything, you know, walking to the bus stop, getting up, going to school, you know, raising my hand in school, reading, you know, school was hard. You know, I was dyslexic and, you know, it was difficult. My sister had none of that. So we looked, you know, in retrospect, looking through, you know, I looked at things very differently. I looked through things in like different lenses than I felt other people. I always wanted to be someone else or, you know, just not myself because I didn't know how to say anything. You know, when that, and that was childhood, you know, I remember very vividly details of childhood because it was, everything was hard and scary. And, but where it changed was, you know, again, I had an older sister, 4 years older. When I was 12, she had a party at the house and New Year's Eve, and there was some champagne on the table. And for me, I figured I would try it. You know, everyone else was drinking, so I tried some champagne. And I remember that changed my life. You know, all of the fears, all of the things I was afraid of, couldn't say, I could say. You know, it just relieved me of the stress and the anxiety. So, at that point, I realized this is what I've been missing out of my whole life, you know, and that was the start for me, the first drink. And, you know, it was a slow progression, you know, okay, throughout life. You know, I played sports, so that was a big part of keeping me, you know.
Did the sports keep you away from, you know, the alcohol and drugs, whatever else it was?
It helped me with a routine. You know, because I was so full of fear about everything, playing sports, specifically football, because that's what the tough kids did. And I was afraid of the tough kids, you know, so I figured, you know, let me do this and maybe I'll be accepted, you know, because I didn't feel accepted.
It's so funny looking at you, like you look like a tough kid, right? Like you are, you know, clearly work out and all this stuff. I can't even imagine. But was there anything that caused that? Like, was there any messaging that you feel like you received? Like, I remember when I was younger, they would be like, don't get in the white van. And I was always afraid of that. And I was always afraid that I'd be kidnapped. And I would sit in bed at night and be afraid of that.
Me too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Me too. Like I couldn't, like, going to sleep at night was hard because those things would go in my mind. You know, we remember, like, we'd have those commercials and like, I'm like, is that going to happen to me? And like, all those things. But more so it was, you know, the neighborhood, you know, because, you know, and there was no, you know, it wasn't a terrible neighborhood, but in Ossining at that time, it was, you know, a very working class town. So it was important to be tough, you know. Mm. It was better to be tough in school than to get good grades, you know, and that was for sure. And I wasn't, I didn't feel I was right. Inside. It was all the inside feelings that I couldn't express because men don't cry. Men don't get scared, you know, suck it up. All of those things that, you know, I've heard movies, you know, everything was reinforced for that.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a lot of kids that were older in the neighborhood and, you know, I wanted to be like them. So I, you know, football, like the reason why I bring that up is because I wasn't good. And I got beat up every day at practice. But I went back, you know, the next day. And then that started to change where then I realized, okay, I can work out harder than everyone and I can take the beatings. So, you know, I want to turn it around. I want to be the one handing it out. Mm. And it was kind of a switch. So later as, you know, high school progressed, you know, then I started to excel in football and played, you know, middle linebacker, which is an aggressive position. Not because I was the best on the team, but, you know, because I was tough. And I felt like when I put the helmet on, I could leave the fear and everything else.
Right. It was alone. Like your protection.
Yeah. It was a freedom. It was the same freedom that I experienced from drinking. You know, all the fear that I walked around with in school, when I put the helmet on, now it's my turn. So it's just like, you know, it's like the mask that, you know, we talk about, you know, where, you know, I think it's pretty common. And that was for me, like, it was a release, I guess. Release is probably a good word, like mm-hmm. a release of all this, the tension and fear that I carried around all day. And, you know, I went to, you know, and that kind of progress, you know, and then on the weekends, you know, the, you know, drinking, you know, and doing those types of things, you know, we drank, beer. Beer didn't really work well for me. So I would steal vodka, steal parents' liquor and, you know, drink beers. And yeah. We thought we were, you know, it was also the time in like the early 80s, listened to gangster music. So we drank 40s, you know,
I mean, thought I that was it. Cool. Yeah. No, for sure. I feel yeah. like. I'm a little, like I grew up a little later, but I had that same experience, you yeah. know, where we would steal the liquor, we would do all of that. So I feel like it's almost like a rite of passage, sure. right? It's what you do. Sure. I mean, I think the difference between us is that, you know, other people kind of grow out of it.
Yeah.
And then other people grow into it, like me.
Well, and it wasn't something that, you know, I was super aware of. And again, like my older sister was slash older brother. My sister was extremely tough and had no fear, where mm. I got all the fear. So, you know, she thought it was normal. Like, you know, so she would actually get me, you know, the alcohol. You know, she had the birds and the bees talk with me. You know, she was like, listen, this is what you need to do with women. And, you know, and, but always wear, you know, protection. Right. And then here's the protection. So it was awesome. Like,
that's actually a great older sister, right?
Yeah. I mean, like she gave me the inside scoop. Yeah. Pretty cool. Kathy was always a protector, of me, you know, she used to joke around. Yeah. If we were in jail, you'd be my, you know, my bitch. No one can mess with you except for me. And I'm like, yeah. And no one gave me a hard time about it because, like, they knew how tough my sister was.
Right.
But anyway, so, you know, I went to college, you know, played sports in college, and that helped keep me in a routine where things didn't get out of control. You know, I went to a local college, private college, Marist in Poughkeepsie. So it wasn't too far from home, you know, still close enough, but, you know, it was great years. Like I was able to grow up a little bit in college.
Were you at that time still just drinking or had you, you know, started doing other substances?
Yeah, I tried weed, you know, it really right. wasn't my thing.
Okay.
You know, I wanted, you know, drinking was always a thing, but like I didn't drink every day.
Right.
I drank on the weekends, you know, and, you know, also too, like couldn't be drunk when I went home. So we would drink early, you know, and that was something, my parents were not big drinkers. You know, my mother really, you know, when we were younger, had a couple of drinks. My father would have a couple of drinks. We had a lot of people over from Ireland during that time. It was a time where Belfast was having wars. So, you know, my parents were part of the Irish Children's Fund, would bring kids over for the summer. And they would all, you know, with the chaperones, would drink a lot. So I would see that, but it wasn't a normal thing. It wasn't a constant thing. My parents kept, you know, that very under control. And, you know, so it was frowned upon. You know, I didn't find out till later that my grandfather was an alcoholic. My father's twin brother was an alcoholic, because that wasn't talked about.
Right, of course.
You know, and it wasn't...
facade.
Yeah.
Everything looks good on the outside, but on the inside, you know, we don't talk about that.
Yeah. And, you know, it was a different time too. Mm. So people didn't really understand it the way that they, I think, you know, is due today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in school, in college, you know, I drank, you know, on the weekends, you know, would get into some bar fights once in a while, but it wasn't, in my opinion, out of control or anyone else's really. I just, you know, was a heavy drinker, you know, on the weekends and only really on the weekends. But I still had this inside angst, you know, I think, you know, young, you know, full of testosterone, you know, and so I would, you know, playing sports wasn't enough. So I wanted to learn how to box. You know, and I, you know, friend who's in the military and, you know, taught me how to box, and that was relieving, you know, it helped get some of the angst out.
Right.
So I continue that, you know, through college and outside.
So now you're in college, like you're still in college, and do you know what you kind of want to be when you grow up, so to say, you know?
I didn't. I wanted to, you know, I was into girls, my friends, and I was getting an education, you know, I worked, you know, hard enough in school to get a good education, but I didn't have a career that I knew I wanted to go into. And I didn't have a lot of guidance from that perspective. Mm. So, you know, I graduated with a sociology degree, did an internship in my last semester and realized that I didn't really buy into it 100%.
Yeah.
So when I graduated, you know, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So I went back to school and got a master's degree in human resource management.
So, I mean, you were pretty smart, like,
yeah,
to want to go back to school and do all that. Your dyslexia never like held you back, or did you learn how to cope?
I learned how to maneuver it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I had, you know, for me, it was very difficult to, like, I'm much better like listening and then being able to retain it versus taking notes. So if there was something like that, I would have to, like, if I was trying to take notes and listen, I wouldn't be able to do it, and it would get jumbled up. Like it would just kind of get confusing. So I would have somebody else take the notes and I would copy their notes and then like be able to do it, like, and take the
test. That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So I worked ways around it. You know, and it was, you know, that was, it was difficult. I had to work harder, which was never a problem. Like, that was something I was okay with, you know, working harder. You know, and then, you know, graduated school, you know, there was always something higher that I wanted to achieve. Drinking was never the number one thing. It was always there and it was always looked towards. And that was like the relief, you know, when I could drink on the weekends, that was the, I could take
and that breath. Was just on the weekends at this point. I mean, because like, this is a very rare thing. A lot of people I speak to, I mean, by college, they're already on like drug number 10, you know?
Yeah.
So I find that incredible that you saved yourself to the weekend.
Well, I grew up in the time of like crack is whack, you know, crack.
Yeah.
Like, I grew up, and this was interesting. So in high school, you know, like I said, it was very working class. So there was a lot of Irish, Italian, and Blacks. And, you know, my summer job was cutting grass, you know, and, you know, my Italian friends are working for their uncles. And, you know, the other side, like, some of my Black friends were selling crack, and they made a lot more money than I did. But, you know, I also saw like downtown, like what it looked like. And it was like not something that was ever, it was never out there. It was never something that like was at parties or never did in college. Never saw cocaine, never saw any, you know, drugs. Some people smoked weed and things like that. But again, wasn't my thing. You know, did I drink when I drank? Did I drink a lot? Yes. You know, but I thought, you know, it was normal, you know.
So when did, you know, did things start looking bad after you got your master's?
I had the disease for me was very, very slow and progressive. You know, I wanted to achieve, I wanted to make money. I was always, money was a big thing. I was always afraid of not having enough, you know, like I think that that stems from my family. You know, we had enough, but it was always tight and it was always talked about. You know, it was, you know, I watched my parents every Sunday sit in the kitchen and write the bills out, you know, and write, make sure that there was enough for food or putting away for savings and, you know, which led to my career as, you know, a financial advisor. You know, that was something that, you know, just came natural to me. And being able to, and also I knew that I wanted to help people and I just didn't know in what capacity. So, you know, I continued working. I worked down by Wall Street for a few years as an executive recruiter. And it was during the time of, you know, late 90s, then early 2000, then 9/11, which I was there for. And after that, you know, I wanted to go back to Westchester where my friends were. I didn't like living in the city, you know, so I went back to Westchester and started, you know, got a job in a financial firm. One of my buddies got me a job there and started to get licensed and, you know, moved on to, to start building like a career. I met my wife, my first wife, at the financial firm. And then went to, my parents were retiring and their financial advisor went out to dinner, got to meet with them. And then we, I really loved what he did in helping people in financial planning. So, we formed a relationship and I started working with him. You know, drinking was now a part of that, you know, and like I've now experienced cocaine. So cocaine was part of the picture.
A once in a while thing? So at this point, you're still drinking. Cocaine is becoming a part of it. And, you know, it's mid-2000s.
Yeah. Right?
And so does cocaine become a more regular thing?
Yeah, it picked up. Because now my buddies are a little bit older, you know, one of them lived in the city.
You have money.
Yeah. And we'll have some money. And, you know, he worked for a record label. So that was, you know, go to parties, you know, go to private parties, get in, you know, and, you know, cocaine was, you know, a big thing. You know, we'd get cocaine and then go out at 12 o'clock at night and stay out all night. But it was still like, you know, like it was able to keep under wraps. Like I loved it, enjoyed it. And you know, it allowed me to drink the way I wanted to and more and keep going. But, you know, then I could put it down.
So Monday came, you were able to separate, okay, cocaine, alcohol, still a weekend thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Eventually it started becoming like, you know, during the week, get home from work, have a couple of drinks, you know, once in a while, like throw some cocaine in there, but still like be able to get to sleep so I could go to work the next day.
Right.
Again, women were always, you know, very important. So that kind of, you know, eventually would change, but it didn't change yet.
At this point you're married as well.
So yeah. So then I, later on, you know, I, you know, meet my wife, we get married. One of the feelings though, is that there still was always this like chasing empty feeling, you know, that I tried, you know, with like doing kickboxing and boxing that didn't fill the void, you know, getting married did not fill the void, you know, getting a career where I had a career path and was building and becoming successful, did not fill that void that I was searching. Is that
wanting more feeling, or you didn't know what you wanted?
I didn't know. I just never felt happy and content and comfortable in my skin. And I always place that as, when I achieve this, then I know I'll be able to be happy. Like then I've reached that goal. I'm going, you know, I'm sure then I will be happy. You know, I tried to fill the void of like the fear as a child with, I'm going to learn how to protect myself, learn like mixed martial arts. And, you know, then I won't be afraid of men. Then I will make money and be successful and get respect, and women will like me, you know. Like, it was just always the feeling of not enough, you know, right. Not tall enough, not fill in the, you know, the blank, just not enough. And that's the feeling that I've always had that plagued me, except when I drank or did drugs. When I put something into my system, I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking, you know, I was like relieved. Yeah. It was just like, you know, it was like I could take a deep breath. And then, you know, and that started to happen more and more slowly. You know, it wasn't overnight where I decided right. to
you know, become an alcoholic.
Yeah. You know,
and it's progressive.
It for me, it was very slow. And, you know, it just the daily grind. So for me, it was like fast forward to my early 40s. You know, I'm you know, now I'm drinking a lot. You know, and
daily.
Yeah. You know, I'd race home from work, you know, so I could, you know, drink, you know, I would, you know, have the giant, you know, just stereotype the giant jug of vodka hidden in the garage. So I could go pour a pint of vodka to calm the nerves, you know, and then, you know, crack open a bottle of wine and have a glass ready. So when my wife got home, that's what she smelled. And that was, you right. know, what was going on. And I had secret stashes all over the house. I had a big gun safe in the garage where I kept the cocaine, you know, and that was something that.
So that was now secret. On a daily basis too.
So in my late 30s, like that started becoming, you know, a daily thing. And I started accumulating stuff. So I had the nice house, you know, I had the cars, you know, the stuff, my business, I was building a business.
Your financial advisor. So you're doing really well.
Yeah. I mean, it's slow. Like it takes years to build that, but it was building and I was becoming successful, but it was like always stress, you know, of not having enough. Right. Like, and then, you know, what am I doing next? And there was a lot of pressure, but I loved what I did. It wasn't the work, and I loved my clients and working with people, but it wasn't the work. It was the inside that wasn't fulfilled, you know? And then it's like, the next thing is like, okay, well, we need to have kids. That's what's, you know, going to make us happy. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, like I find out that like, I can't have children. And, I didn't have a good my wife and I didn't have good communication. You know, part of that is, you know, my fault, you know, but, you know, it just, we spoke, we were on different levels. We just didn't, you know, communicate well. She, you know, she wasn't a bad person. You know, when I described her first in recovery, it was her fault.
Of course.
You know, and I was drinking more. She was, you know, catching me. No, not to the level that I was, but like once in a while, she would catch me like passed out on the couch, you know, before I didn't come up in time. Or find like the hidden glass of vodka. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you doing? It's Wednesday, you know?
Right.
And, you know, and that was normal. And things were very cold between us. So, you know, eventually, like, I saw it outside the house, you know, and like, I, you know, and that's something that I was not very proud of, you know, meeting, you know, somebody else besides my wife. And, but I just felt so unloved and so not noticed in my own home that it was so emotionally draining for me. Like that was like when I felt the most bankrupt. And, you know, after all I do for you and us, right. You know, like the selfishness, right? All I do for you, you can't see me. Like I'm not even top five on your list of important people. And eventually, you know, we divorced and And going through that process, I was introduced to some other substances, you know, pain medication. Like,
did you get into an app? Like, was there any sort of
injury? No, I've had injuries where I've taken pain medication where I was like, wow, that's great. And then I went over to a buddy's house and, you know, he had some Roxy's and he was like, try this.
Roxy's? You know,
and introduced, and it was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, this is, you know, kind of, again, you know, the same feeling when introduced to drinking cocaine and now Roxy's. It's like, wow, what a relief. And I, you know, and I'll drink on top of it and I don't need to drink as much in my head.
Right.
You know, eventually that's not true. So that became, you know, part of the deal. And, you know, that, you know, once in a while or once a week, you know, became an everyday thing.
Were you getting sick at this point or not yet?
No, I mean,
you hadn't.
I started building up a pretty big tolerance for drinking and substances, you know. So, you know, now I move in with a buddy of mine, you know, and go back to a small house that I'm like renting. After we sell, you know, the house, you know, I have, you know, still working, you know, at the same company. It's, you know, I'm a partner in the company. So,
huge.
So I'm trying to, you know, maintain and still work. I never missed work, but.
Could they tell that something had shifted in you?
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, cause I was very close with my partner. I, you know, he's one of my close friends, you know, I love him. And, you know, so it was difficult cause I wanted to show up for him. You know, and I wanted to show up for my family. I just like the drugs and alcohol were taking over. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like I was becoming possessed and I couldn't stop. Nor did I want to. You know, I knew that like this wasn't going to continue forever, but I just didn't know how it was going to stop. At that point, you know, I was dating someone much younger than myself. And, you know, from another country, thought that that was, you know, we're going to you know, live a happy life and that's going to, you know, be the end all. I was able to compartmentalize things and not live in reality. You know, the reality is like, it's a terrible decision. Right. This is not the case. You're both using each other.
Right.
You know, me financially and her for, you know, what I transposed as love. You know, it was what I was missing in my first relationship or my marriage. And I transposed that to love and it wasn't, you know, like, you know, I was just filling the gap. And where I guess like it started coming out is like, you know, I would show up to places that you're not supposed to show up to drunk and high and different, you know, they, you know, at my, you know, niece's, you know, she was like, I don't know, 7 or 8, you know, and going on a Wednesday morning to go see her in a show. And, you know, I obviously was drunk, you know, showing up to places like that. And that's when my sister like really realized something was wrong. Cause I tried to blame the divorce, going through a rough time, you know, and like just to keep everyone at bay. Well, she came over and saw the reality, you know, like where I wasn't being, I couldn't eat a meal, you know, without having proper, you know, amount of alcohol in myself. Like, you know, I would just get sick and, you know, throw up. And that's when I went to my first rehab. It was back in 2017. And you know, I went to, you know, my sister.
Did they have an intervention for you?
Or? They had a couple interventions that
you like, said no to.
I was like, yeah, I, you know, low key, like was like, yeah, thank you. I appreciate, you know, your concern, but you know. You know,
I'm good.
Thank you for your unsolicited input. You know? And, but this, you know, when my sister came over and saw like me and my, you know, drinking and drugs, like she, you know, it was pretty apparent and I knew it was. So I agreed to go. She picked me up the next morning and, you know, she allowed me to bring a bottle with me because she thought that, you know,
you might go into withdrawal.
Yeah. So that's what, you know, she learned. So I remember driving down, you know, for 2 hours to the, you know, facility and just having her turn away as I drank the bottle of vodka in the back seat, you know, from the bottle. You know, it was just like, that was pretty humiliating, but I couldn't stop.
Yeah.
And
I mean, and you run at that point, you run the risk of having a seizure, of serious withdrawal.
My body was 100% fully like addicted, but I wasn't going to stop. Like I felt pains, you know, in my lower back, but I just would compartmentalize it and put it out, you know, right. And I couldn't stop, you know, and I wasn't willing to. So, you know, I went to my first rehab, you know, for 30 days, you know, and, you know, the first few days were a little rough. But, you know, after, you know, I started working out again in the morning, you know, and started getting in a routine, they would have meetings and talk about the 12 steps, you know, and I raised my hand in every meeting, you know, and introduced myself as Michael Alcoholic, because I figured they wouldn't let me out of there if I didn't do that. You know, I just thought I needed, you know, a little break, you know, because I've been drinking now for 30 years, pretty hardcore, without breaks, you know, and then like, you know, all right, so this probably be good for my liver.
Vacation.
And, you know, I got back home, you know, and within a, you know, and I didn't take any of the suggestions, like go to meetings, IOP and all that stuff. I'm like, no, thank you. I'm busy. You know, I have to get back to work. I just missed 30 days. I need to go make up for all of this. And that was what I felt after every rehab I went to. It was biding time there, and it was catching up on life when I got out.
Right.
So I had to go even faster. And then shortly thereafter, you know, I'm drinking again.
You're crumbling.
Right back where I am, you know, right back to, you know, the substances and, you know, just, you know, I was getting older, so I figured, you know, cocaine's probably not good for my heart. So, you know, that's when, you know, the pills, you know, I thought the pills would make more sense, which is totally crazy.
Yeah. So the pain pills, you mean, not like
the Roxy's. Yeah.
And you were you still a partner in your firm? Like, were you still able to, do you call it a firm when it's a financial thing?
Yeah, it was a practice.
Yeah.
Financial planning practice.
And so you were still a partner. Your partner didn't feel like you were not a good fit anymore or any of that?
Not at that. I mean, at that point, he was still willing to give me.
Help you.
Yeah. And like, you know,
you guys were friends too.
Friends. And I was a big part of building the practice.
Right.
You know, so, you know, and he wanted, you know, yeah. So he gave me more than a few chances. You know, I went to multiple rehabs, you know, thereafter. And it was because my sister just wouldn't leave me alone. Like she just wouldn't get off my back. And I remember being so venomously angry at her, like to leave me alone and just get off my back. And you don't understand, go live your life. And, you know, and she wouldn't,
which thank probably, you. Yeah. Thank you. Right.
Yeah, just
in hindsight.
So now in 2019, I now have push the limits with my practice. So I decided, you know, either to split my practice or sell it. So I decided to sell it and take some time off, you know, and get better.
Did you burn through that money?
No.
Oh, okay. That's good.
No, I went, and the reason why is, one, cause I'm not that kind of person.
Right.
You know,
and well, because I know that a lot of people who are on pain medication and take those pills, and then when they can't find the pills, they either get them from a more expensive dealer or.
Well, I was making a lot of money at the time.
Right.
So I could pay out of but what changed was, there was no Marshman Act in New York. So my sister, who decided that, you know, she needed to figure out what to do with me. So, she invited me over to her house, you know, with my parents there. So if my mother is there, I'm not, like, she knew I wasn't going to get out of control. And then when I got there, she called the police and had, you know, like 10 people come.
Wow.
And knew what to say. She, you know, I feel like my brother might hurt himself or hurt us. We need to have him checked out to make sure he's not on anything. And like, I didn't want to get arrested, but I was not happy.
Oh my God. I would have been livid.
So, but I like, I knew it would be very bad if I like, you know, I told, you know, and I told the police, like, I was like, listen, don't touch me. I'll go with you. You know, just don't put any handcuffs on me and don't touch me and I'll get in the car and I'll go. And
But that's not a Marchman Act, right?
No,
a Marchman
that's Act just going to this. Yeah, that's just going to the psych ward.
So how did they Marchman Act you from that point?
They didn't. Okay. So they got me there and she figured out a way to have them keep me there for 10 days. They took me to the hospital that had locked doors. So while I was there, you know, this was like the end. Like I was at this point, I'm like, this game is over.
This is right before I meet you.
No. This is like, I'm like hopeless. Like, I'm like, you know, I've had a decent run at life and game's over. You know, I'm like, this is like, when I get out of here, like I'm done, you know, I'm going, you know, and that's like, I was okay with that. You know, I was okay with like, I can't keep going like this. This is, I got nothing to live for, like hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. And then, you know, at night, like around 7 o'clock, they bring, you know, they have like snack time. So they bring out some animal crackers and some juice, which is, you know, I come out and I'm in my pajamas. Yeah. It's, you know, it's pretty cool. And, you know, and they're like, hey, Michael, someone's here to see you. And one of the guys, Zach Clark.
I know Zach.
Yeah. A lot of people know Zach now. I stayed at Release one of the times or two of the times that I was, you know, after treatment. And he came in and I'm like, why are you here? He's like, you know, this was a pivotal moment in my journey where he was like, you know, Michael, your story doesn't end like this. And he gave me,
thank God,
he opened up the door enough for me to agree to come to Florida. And so I agreed to get on a plane and go to, you know, to Florida and try this one more time, you know. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, an easy journey. I went to Karen and, you know, I stayed around long enough where eventually, you know, COVID happened and then they nicely asked me to leave. I character assassinated my therapist. You know, it was her fault, and I just attacked her like for not having my back and this and that. And Karen kicked me out. My family wasn't happy. So I went to a halfway house and then like wasn't taking direction. Like I didn't want to like be a part of Karen anymore. And like, you know, and then my family, you know, at that point, you know, this is another pivotal thing that happened for me was my family decided that they've had enough. You know, they didn't want to communicate with me anymore. And they set a boundary that we're not going to, this is my mother who is in her early, you know, mid 70s, you know, and, you know, I loved very much. And like the only person that I felt like any emotional connection to, you know, I was fine with not having my sister because, you know, I blamed her for everything.
Of course.
And then, you know, but my entire family got together and, you know, said that they're not going to communicate with me, no letters, nothing for a year.
That must have been hard to hear though.
And then it was like, well, what do I do now? Like, you know, I'm irritable, uncomfortable. I can't sleep. Like I'm just out of my mind. And like, you know, it was the worst feeling because like I had zero solution and I knew I was the problem. And yeah. I'm like, what do I do now? And it was COVID. So, and thank God for that. You know, it's now the hindsight. Now I get to go and like look back at this and it was like God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And right. He put men that like Big John, Jimmy, a whole score of men, you know, in my life, you know, mm-hmm. to therapy twice a week. And thank God, the woman that I was going to therapy for with, she was a big promoter of AA and she would hold me accountable. She's like, are you going to those Zoom meetings at night at 5 o'clock? And I would be on these Zoom meetings with men and they would, men who were, I respected, like, and not that I knew them, but like, I could tell that they were strong and being vulnerable. and gave me the words to be able to express what was going on inside, mm-hmm. and talked about that. And it was like, it was scary. It was uncomfortable. And, you know, being able to, you know, I couldn't put a sentence together, you know, sitting there, and I was just, you know, I didn't know if I could cry or wanted to smash something. Like, it was all of these mixed emotions, and it was horrible, horrible, but I kept doing it, you know, day after day. And then, you know, things started to change. Like, I started finding words to be able to express myself. I started getting permission to cry because Big John said he cried, so it's okay if I cry. Like, it was things that, like, I wouldn't let myself do that, like, now I could do.
Yeah.
And, like, it started taking that boiling pot of water, which is what I felt like all the time, and it started taking the, you know, it started to cool down.
I'm so happy you came on. I'm really appreciative of you telling your story and getting vulnerable and, you know, opening up. And, you know, hopefully this resonates with people out there. And thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was amazing. I appreciate it.